House Committee on Healthcare, Subcommittee on Healthcare Access, and I open a work session on 2348. We have a couple of amendments in front of us today that we may or may not consider. Is there somebody from OMA here to talk about the dash ones?
They said they were going to be here, Mr. Chair. I emailed them this morning.
Okay. That takes care of that one. Is there somebody here who wants to talk about the dash twos or the dash fours? Please come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Mangan, Regional Vice President of the American Council of Life Insurers, and I spoke to you last week about this bill. The Dash 4 amendments were our response to actually a kind of an updated version of what I think were the Dash 2 amendments, which attempted to carve out the disability income product line that we talked to you about last week. And what we did is simply try to clarify that exclusion in order to make sure that it was clear that what we're trying to exclude is disability income insurance policies or any policy like that does not reimburse for medical expenses, because I know that your intention as a committee, at least the testimony, went to the payment or reimbursement of medical expenses for treatment of an injury. And what we're trying to get at is these policies do not pay for that. They pay cash to individuals who buy them, their financial contracts. So we simply clarified that in the in Section 3, Sub 2, to make sure that that was crystal clear. And with that change, our concerns would be taken care of.
Could you please give us some examples of what other than disability insurance might be covered? We're looking for the definition right now in 731.
Mr. Chair, there are a lot of small supplemental products, which when you start listing them, they tend to kind of get out of hand, but they are, in some cases, they're excluded under Oregon definitions, such as the definition of health benefit plan in Oregon statutes. Affirmatively excludes things like dental insurance, accident-only policies, specified disease contracts, disability income contracts. There's a laundry list of these supplemental contracts that aren't medical insurance. And so that's why we felt that it was best to make sure that the exclusion was clear about what you're trying to take off the table there.
And the supplemental disease insurance isn't medical insurance?
Well, some of these, Mr. Chairman, some of these contracts, I'm not even sure. The titles of them have varied. There's a lot of new product innovation. And what I guess we're trying to say is that if they don't reimburse for medical expenses, then they're really not the subject, I don't think, the intended subject of your bill. Again, accident insurance is quite a bit different. It pays the individual money in the case of an accident. Dental insurance is often excluded from the definition of health insurance because it's considered a different type of product. So those are the things that may or may not get swept in when you use the broad definition of health insurance.
Are there any other questions? How comfortable would you be if we just had the dash twos?
Mr. Chair, we really would recommend the clarity of the dash four. We think there are some product lines that you would inadvertently sweep in with the dash two.
Well, my problem is you haven't given us much clarity right now. You've just given us, at least me, you've given me some concern that there may be things in there that aren't intended to be in there by the same token. I understand disability insurance, and that's certainly your biggest concern, right?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, it obviously is. So I think, I'm not sure if the AHIP representative is here today, but I know that in talking to that organization, their companies actually write more of these supplemental type contracts. So it might be helpful to hear from them. But we think that the dash four would be more effective and clearer in defining what you're really trying to accomplish in terms of treatment of an injury or payment of medical expenses.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're in work session. What does the committee feel about this? We'll deal with the dash twos and fours first. The vice chair, either Mr. Vice Chairs.
Looking at the dash two, certainly it is designed to apply to exclude disability income insurance. The dash four turns it around, and instead of excluding disability insurance, it says it will not include anything except for medical policies. And so I assume that if we could come up with a list of policies that would be expanded, such as maybe long-term care, or, like you said, dental, or accident policies. But I don't know about PIP wage loss. So it just kind of comes down to whether or not the amendment is designed to protect disability policies or to assure that the benefit only applies to medical policies.
Representative Minnis?
Well, the clearer we can make it, Mr. Chair, the better. Oftentimes you might see a policy that runs out of this committee or any committee, and if it's not clearly defined, then it's misinterpreted. So whatever clarifies it the best. I'm hearing Representative Richardson indicating he likes the dash twos better, or did you say that?
Seems clearer.
Mm-hmm. It's certainly more, you know what you're getting with the dash two.
Yeah. Mr. Powell, would you want to comment on this? I'm sorry, Representative Cannon. You had.
That's okay. I was just going to.
So quiet there.
I did the little point. I mean, it seems like there may be a policy decision here between the dash two and dash four. They'll have different consequences, and I'm just—it's not very clear to me yet what those consequences would be. So
I'm—that's what it feels to me as well. Mr. Paul?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify. My name is John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Mr. Chairman and members, I apologize for having missed the original hearing on this bill. We do have some concern about the language in all of the amendments, and that is the sub 1 of section 3. It would appear that one could read that language that somebody who's intoxicated or under the influence of controlled substances might have preferential treatment over other policyholders in a health insurance policy.
I'm sorry. Did that same language come through in the twos?
Yes.
He lost me. It says sub 1, section 3.
And legal counsel at Regents had looked at this and just today had time to respond to another way of providing for the same thing. And it would simply word it by citing the statute that defines a health benefit plan. So instead of saying or using the language in section 3 sub 1, that the recommended language would be subject to the provisions and conditions of the policy. No health benefit plan as defined in ORS 743730 shall exclude from coverage a loss sustained or contracted in consequence of the insured's being under the influence of a controlled substance or intoxicated. And the terms subject to the provisions and conditions of the policy would mean if deductibles apply, co-payments apply, they would apply to the intoxicated person just like they would somebody who's not under the influence of drugs or alcohol. If you take the pure reading of the LC drafts...
Excuse me, Mr. Paul. If I may, I think for the committee that section 3 sub 1 is a separate amendment. That's amendment dash 1, and I think we need a dash 2 amendment unless we decide we want the dash 1s, which is a separate decision. It does not include section 3 sub 1. And I think what we want before us, and I'm sorry that it didn't come up and we'll need to postpone this, I feel perfectly comfortable with the section 3-2, section 3 sub 2 of the dash 2s.
Mm-hmm.
It was my intention that the dash 2 amendments only excluded disability and didn't deal with the content of the dash 1s. The OMA is with us now, and we'll have a discussion of that, but at the moment I'm not prepared to entertain the dash 1s or sub 1 of section 3, and I think that would take away a lot of your problem.
Mr. Chairman, it would, and I might just add, as a consequence from being an insurance agent in another life, there are some other products, such as accidental death products, that do have limitations when it comes to controlled substances that might be influenced by this. I'm not quite sure whether they fall under the definition of health insurance, but that's problematic in the Oregon law. Not all state laws throw a lot of these policies under the definition of, quote, health insurance, and that's why we thought it would be wise to use the specific statutory reference to a health benefit plan in the statute, which would make it very, very clear under Oregon law what's excluded and what's not. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Paul. If it is all right with the committee, let's ask the proponent of the sub ones to have a little discussion. Then we can sense whether we want to do what's in the sub one or we want to take it one step at a time. And that's delete the exclusion without putting the positive language in. And who's here for OMA today? Hi, come on. Talk to us about the sub ones. I mean the dash ones. Sub one. Section 3, sub 1, and the dash 1s.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Claudia Black, and I'm here today representing the Oregon Medical Association. And the dash 1 amendments were proposed at the request of the Oregon Medical Association. We supported the concept of the bill and felt that it was a very important thing to codify. However, we felt that simply by remaining silent on the language, that it didn't go quite far enough, and so we suggested this language is very similar to Washington State statute, which says that health insurance companies shall not exclude from payment or reimbursement any losses sustained as a result of insureds being under the influence of a controlled substance or intoxication. What we're hearing sort of informally from some of our ER docs is that there, as Dr. Lace testified last week, that there's a concern about actually coding appropriately and putting in if someone is under the influence of a particular substance because of the insurance exclusion in some of the policies.
Are there any questions?
I would just point out to the chair that this amendment, the dash one addition that's been described to us, is carried through in the dash two and the dash four. So
I do know that. Okay. I think that's accidental. And if we get to, if we decide as a committee we want to do the dash ones, then we can handle the dash twos because we've decided we want to do the dash ones and it's carried through. If we don't want to do the dash ones at this point, then we need to postpone it.
Right.
This until the next time. Come back with a dash two or four, whichever we decide on that. That's
minus
minus the sub one. Right. Section 3 sub 1 language in the dash 2.
Okay.
In the dash 1.
Mr. Chair, I might mention the testimony that we received as to why we need to have this fix is because medical doctors want to get paid. They're seeing patients who may be intoxicated. If they put down they're intoxicated, then it's going to get excluded. There'll be no pay. And so they focus on the injury but leave out the very important part.
Right.
And the
bill itself would prohibit health insurance companies from excluding alcohol and substance abuse. I mean, which was what the proponents asked for. Insurance can't do.
I guess I'm speaking to the dash four amendments in that what they do is they are essentially saying if it's a medical issue, then the dash four says that the section does not apply to disability insurance policy or any other insurance or reimbursement that does not provide for medical expenses. And so it's basically saying if the issue is medical, then this, then focus on making sure it applies to medical and don't have it unintendedly apply to other things that may not be medically related. And so I guess what I'm bringing up is if there's other reasons why it needs to be expanded beyond medical, then okay. Otherwise, this may not be a bad amendment because it's saying if the idea is to focus on medical so that people can get help, then this would apply to medical.
But what's before us now is the language of 3 sub 1 in all of those amendments, which is the content of the dash 1 amendment. And that's the OMA wanting to, at this point, not only take away the ability of insurance companies to exclude these conditions, but put positive language in it that forces them to cover it. Yes, sir.
I guess my understanding was the current statute says that insurers may exclude for these reasons, for intoxication, et cetera, and the original bill would have left the statutes neutral, silent. It would have just struck that section, meaning the statutes were silent about what insurers can or cannot do with respect to intoxication or controlled substance. And I think what OMA has proposed, and it seems quite sensible to me, and certainly in keeping with the intention of House Bill 2348, is to say very directly that it is not permissible to exclude on the basis of these intoxication. And I would submit that this is a good amendment.
And if that's the sense of the committee, we can move in that direction.
Which is the dash? I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
It's
the dash fours. The dash which?
Well, we're only talking about dash ones now.
Okay.
Because if we approve the dash ones, then we can discuss the dash twos and fours, including the dash ones. We can have a conceptual discussion of whether we want what's in the dash one. If we want what's in the dash one, then we don't even have to. We don't even have to move that. We can go right to the twos or the fours, which I would propose going right to the twos. If we decide not to do the dash ones, then we need a different version of the dash twos. So, it really, we're in a work session now, and I'd be happy to get the opinions of the subcommittee as to whether...
Representative Chair Mitch Greenlick, I support where you're at. I like what's in the dash ones. But if we go with the dash two, then it's all inclusive and it's covered.
Yeah. So the issue is.
I like that.
So you favor moving forward with the OMA's amendment?
Yes, and look, in particular because it's clear the dash twos are clearer than the dash four. I like the language in the dash twos better.
Representative Richardson, you have a sense on the dash ones?
It doesn't appear that there's a lot of resistance from the industry, and it seems like it will clarify a problem of the medical industry not being able to put down everything that they see because of this provision. So I have no problem with it, and I have no problem also assuring that it doesn't apply to disability income.
Representative Minnis?
Looking this over, for one thing, I think, Mr. Chair, I don't want to hasten this. I know you're on a time schedule and you've got things mapped out, but I would request that maybe the chair give us a little more time to massage this and look it over, if you're willing to do so, and postpone it until maybe the next meeting, if you're willing to do that.
We have to postpone it. Well, can we?
Can we send it over and maybe do a work session to at the next meeting? Give us a little time.
Yes. It might.
You can't.
If you announce, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if you announce that you're carrying, if you announce that it's carried over, we can just revise our agenda as a carryover from today's hearing, and the posting requirements are then clearly notified. From today's actions can carry over to Wednesday's actions.
I have no problem with that.
If you're willing to do that, it might be interesting for us to find out from Mr. Mangum why. Just disability policies were acceptable the last time he was here, but now it needs to be the other way. It'd be interesting to know what epiphany is taking place, or understanding, or contact. Just want to know a little bit more about that.
It is evolved.
Well, it would be good to have a little more time to kind of massage this before we take action.
If we're going to do that, we may want to look at Mr. Powell suggested some alternative language to this. Is that right? You think we can get an amendment that compares and looks like that before Wednesday?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure. We'll have to talk to the council.
LC is pretty jammed up.
Yeah.
Let me announce right now so we can do it any time on Wednesday if we announce it any time today.
Yes, as long as you just say you're carrying.
Okay.
Yeah.
Your Honor, my name is Bill Sandu. I regulated these statutes for 16 years with the Insurance Commissioner's Office. Maybe I can shed some of the light on some of the questions you have. The statute we are talking about, ORS 743, period 480, is in the section which is classified as individually issued health insurance policies. So it only applies to individually insurance policies, not to group coverage.
We got testimony on that.
That's one. And the statute we are trying to revise is called, there are mandatory provisions and these are optional provisions. So this is listed under the optional provisions. If you remove this statute, you will be leaving a big vacuum. You can drive a tractor through it. You know, the insurance company can put any provision they want regarding the intoxication and substance influence. So I would go along with the OMA's requirement that companies may not exclude coverage for these situations. And also, it's up to you folks to decide if you're willing to put in exclusion, exclude disability only, no other coverages. Just apply to disability only, like you have in the number two.
Right.
I think that would be the clearest way of stating it, sir. So that's what I would recommend it.
Thank you very
from
much.
My own experience, because I don't leave it vacuums. So
sounds like sound advice.
Maybe I can answer any other question you have, sir.
Right. I'd like to get Mr. Powell back up. At least one member of the committee wasn't really listening to you at the time because he was trying to figure out what was going on. So if you would...
Mr. Chairman, if that means four or five were, I'm ahead of my normal course.
I can't speak for the other four.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, John Powell representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. And I do appreciate this opportunity. I know you're in work session and many of us attended a funeral on the day you had the original hearing on this bill, and I do appreciate your generosity with your time. The Regents does not exclude payments on this basis right now. So that has nothing to do with our desire to have clarity in this amendment. My only point was that if you read the language in the LC amendments, it basically says that the health insurance policy shall pay any payment or reimburse a sustained through a loss if the person's intoxicated and or subject to controlled substances. My point is that there may be policy provisions that apply to that insured person and any insured person under a policy, such as a copay or a $100 deductible for use of an emergency room, that we believe this language may not allow to be applied to you if you're intoxicated or high, but if you're sober, it would apply to you. That's our only point, Mr. Chairman. So our proposed amendment would add just that language that subject to the provisions and conditions of the policy, no health benefit plan as defined in ORS 743730 shall exclude from coverage a loss sustained or contracted as a consequence of the insured being under the influence of alcohol or controlled substance. So in essence, it's doing the same thing as the OMA amendment, I believe. It's just being more exact and pointing out that the policy conditions or the policy provisions would apply to an intoxicated person as they would somebody who is not intoxicated. That's our main point.
John, I disagree. I don't think the current policy language will prohibit you from applying the deductible or co-insurance to any situation where you have to pay the claim. So I don't think that would come into play at all. That's not what this would do there.
Let me ask this.
Bill and I are old friends. And he's actually one of the nicest persons that's ever worked in the insurance division, and I can attest to that.
Thank you. But it will permit you to apply the deductible and the co-insurance like any other condition.
We're going to carry this over till Wednesday. Let's get, if we can, a set of amendments that represent the dash two with your language in it, so we can compare that with the dash two. We'll try and get it out to the committee before the meeting, so we'll try.
Thank you, Mr.
If he's got the exact words from his counsel, it should help Lori get a version. So what we'd like is a dash two version with a different set of languages in the sub one of section three. And at that point, we'll carry over this work session until Wednesday.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Let me open a public hearing. Representative Smith here?
No.
She's going to testify?
Yeah. I don't believe so.
There was somebody to testify. Okay.
But we have a conference call for this gentleman, the gentleman who requested the bill. So it's up to you how you want, what order you're in.
Is Rocky here as well?
Yes, Rocky's got it.
Good. Let's open a public hearing on House Bill 2440, and we'll test our technology capability here to see if we can actually get a phone call through. Hey, Joel. You can't copy this.
Hello.
Hi. Is this Jerry?
Yes, it is.
Jerry, this is Sandy from the House Healthcare Committee, Subcommittee on Healthcare Access.
Uh-huh.
On the Chair Greenlick has just opened a public hearing on House Bill 2440.
Okay.
So.
This bill is noted as being at your request, is that right?
That's correct.
We'd be happy to hear from you about it, and we have Mr. King from the, whatever that office is now called, that's...
OMIP.
Still OMIP, okay. Also, and we'll see if you can, after you've testified, if you can hear us.
I can hear you.
When he responds. So please go ahead with your testimony. Please identify yourself with your name and address.
Okay, I'm Jerry Dwayne Patrick Cole at 3900 Y East Road, Hoosier, Oregon.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Okay, when I had talked with Patty Smith and Senator Nestor, and I'd written the governor's office too. My main concern about the rate increases was that we got into OMIP in 2005, and we was paying $741 a month. In 2006, it jumped up to $885, and I thought, wow, that's a lot of money. And you know, I retired at 62, and my concern is for people that retire at age 62, from 62 to 65, you know, they have to pick up another insurance. I didn't choose to take COBRA, and so consequently, I went out onto the insurance market to find out that that wasn't a good move. People... with the health history, once you go out, if you have a history at all, the insurance t- companies, they just don't accept you. And so consequently, the wife and myself is put into the medical pool, both of us on different things. And the problem is that once you're on a fixed income, you know, it's difficult to find extra money when there's a large increase in anything. And yet, you know, I realize that they take the national average and figure out what increases they're going to have. And I had no problem with that. I had a problem with being able to go over above that by any percentage. You know, once you, like I said, once you're on the fixed income, you're really, you're stuck with that. That's the money you're going to be getting. And, you know, I've known people that have been in the same position I'm in now, and what they did, it got to a point where they just dropped their insurance altogether. And then they started using the ER room. And, you know, like our hospital, like most hospitals, they have to take you regardless of if you can pay or not. And when they don't pay, you know, sometimes it's written off by the hospital and doctors, but the biggest share of the time, everybody else pays. So I guess in general, I feel that being able to increase over what the national average is by 10, 25, 50, or 75% just shouldn't be.
It's 25 in this case. Right?
Pardon me?
It's 25% in this case.
Yeah, it's been 25, and I'm sure that, you know, they've been able in past years to go up higher than that there. And so, you know, I know that it may mean that if it was for people from 62 to 65, the younger group may have to pick up a little bit more. But, you know, us, we seniors have sacrificed a lot for them. You know, and that's what got me to talk with Patty, and I appreciate everything that she's done to try to get something done about being able to go over, way over the national average when they're figuring out how much the increase should be. But that's my part of it there. If you have any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer.
Well, we'll see if there are any questions, Mr. Pacheco, but you're welcome to stay on the phone and listen to the testimony that's going on if you'd like
okay,
to.
Okay, I will do that.
Are there any questions to Mr. Pacheco?
I have a question.
Please.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Pacheco. I'm Representative Richardson. I have a question for you. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, I can.
Did you check to see what the cost would have been had you elected to take your COBRA benefits?
Yes, I did.
Could you tell us what that would be?
And at that time, it was $748. But you know why I didn't elect to do that? I was naive. I thought that, you know, I'm in super health, and I thought it'd be no problem. I'll get out and I'll go out onto the market and pick up an insurance. And we went out and tried with LifeWise, and they turned both of us down, and we were astounded that that happened. But then once you're turned down, you know, you're done. You're just done. Nobody else will pick you up.
And how much is your current premium for you and your wife?
Right now, the two of us, I believe it's $881 a month, I believe, or $885 a month.
Okay. Are there any other questions of Mr. Patrico? Okay. When I saw Representative Smith had introduced this bill on your behalf, Mr. Patrico,
mm-hmm.
Save me for introducing one on behalf of David Halk, who talked to me over and over again. We'll now call him as a witness.
Okay.
We also have, I hear from our administrator, we have written testimony in opposition to this bill from HealthNet. Great. Dave, welcome.
Thank you.
We had nice coffee together discussing this, right?
Yeah. Good afternoon, and thank you for allowing me to testify. My name is Dave Houck, and before I get into the text of my discussion, I'd like to present some OMIP data to give you an idea of the people in the risk pool. These figures fluctuate, but they're fairly close. There's 15,000 people in the pool, for which 12,700 plus are medically eligible and 2,100 plus are portability eligible, and 56 have a health care tax credit from the federal government. Every county is represented in this pool, and I don't doubt that every district is represented in the pool. Approximately 60% of the pool are women, and roughly 61% of the pool are from age 45 through 64. And for the 500 plan, I didn't have this in my presentation, but for the 500 plan, you would pay anywhere from $328 a month to $519 for that age group of 45 through 64. And approximately 55 of the new policy members since 2004, approximately 55%, earn less than $25,000 a year. And there are approximately 1,800,000 Oregonians with health care insurance, excluding the ERISA insured. I was asked many times 20 years ago, what's the difference between an uninsurable and uninsured? Obviously, the uninsurable are people that have a chronic illness and could not obtain health care from any other source than OMIP. I've served as a public representative on the OMIP board since its inception in 1987. And I'm currently emeritus member, but I still attend the meetings and participate in the board meetings. I feel that the board has always done the best it can under the circumstances to be used for the insured. The state should be proud of OMIP, and because it is considered to be one of the best-run risk pools in the nation. I've always had a problem, however, with one thing, and that is that people with chronic health care issues must pay up to 25% more for their health insurance than most Oregonians. I've always asked myself why, but it was part of the bill when it went in 20 years ago, and we were very happy then just to get an insurance policy. At the time, it was 150%, however, Rocky and I disagree. I think in 1989, they dropped it to 25%, but regardless, it's still 25% more. In OMIP, we have six health plans. For medical eligible, we have four plans. These people pay 125% of a normal premium. For portability, we have two plans, and they are the exact same as two that are in the other. But, however, these, because of federal law, they only pay 100% of a normal policy. If you charge 25% premium each year, it would cost OMIP's insured $45 a month or $540 a year. If you don't charge that 25%, it would cost each person in the state of Oregon who has health insurance, excluding ERISA, 36 cents a month or $4 a year. I know of an OMIP insured Oregonian whose health care last year ran more than $7,200 a year. And quite honestly, it runs about $7,200 a year because of a chronic illness. And this is including OMIP premiums, but without any hospital stays, just doctor appointments and prescription drugs. Is it better for health care for this person to pay $540 more per year, or for each insured person in the state of Oregon to pay $4 more a year? If we had, we did have a big spike in the last OMIP assessment to insurance companies, and at the last board meeting it was brought up that we should raise the insurance rates from our present 111% up to 125%. After a great debate, it was defeated. By dropping the 125% clause to 100%, this discussion would not have occurred. The history of OMIP has been that we do have spikes in the assessment from time to time. Every year when the board discusses premiums...
Dave, would you please wrap it up soon?
I am. I've got 30 seconds more.
Hopefully.
Inevitably, the insurance community wants to raise it to 125. I don't blame them because it's in the law, but it doesn't make it right. In simple terms, whether you charge 100% premium or 125 premium to this group of Oregonians, it won't bring down to any large degree the assessment charged to insurance companies. It will only make people drop out of the OMIP program because they can't afford it. It's wrong to charge any person a premium for health insurance because of a chronic illness. If we are a state that's going to insure all people, you must not have these people paying a premium for their health insurance. Again, please understand, I feel the way we're treating health care in this country is appalling. That's my only figure. But the risk pool is the only way to help uninsurables in this state acquire health insurance under the present system. If health insurers want to gain some other means to help write off this deficit, I would be glad to help them. But please don't do it off the backs of the chronically ill. In closing, I hope you will see the injustice of this program and rectify it by passing House Bill 2440. 15,000 chronically ill Oregonians will applaud your effort. Thank you.
Any questions, Mr.
I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hall.
Thank you.
Mr. Sando? Do you have anything you want to talk?
You're on the list.
Is it for this bill or the other one?
No, that was the other one, sir.
Oh, okay.
But I did work with Mr. Rocky originally because now they're the only one. I'm sorry. Now, come on, forward.
Mr. King, why don't you join us as well?
Again, Your Honor, my name is Bill Sandu. I'm a former compliance officer with the State of Oregon Insurance Department. When originally the bill was passed, I was one of the people who worked with the Rocky King very closely, and we devised the first insurance policy when it was started out. And so it has been very good for the Oregonians. So they could, when they were rejected by the insurance company, they could get insurance, even though the premium, the way it is figured, maybe Rocky can correct me, they take premiums of the five top health insurance company individually issued policies, then they average that insurance, and that's how they come up with the basic rate. And then they increase that by 125%. Is that correct, Rocky?
No, but I'll get into it.
Go ahead. No. That's the way it used to be done.
Used to be.
I'll stay here. Go ahead.
Rocky King, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rocky King. I'm the administrator for the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool. And before I start, I just want to take 1 minute. 20 years ago, I think, it was about 18 years ago, I sat at the end of a table, and Mr. David Houck was at the other end, and it was my interview. And he said, will you commit to stay with a high-risk pool for 2 years if we hire you? And I said, will you commit to keep me for 2 years if you hire me? He said no, and I said no, but I want to point out that 18 years later, we're still here. The other thing I want
And he's still here, too.
And that's what I mean. He's still here. And the other thing I want to say is I have never met a more fine gentleman and a person who has fought for those who have chronic illnesses more than David Houck. He is just one of the most quality people. Sometimes I disagree with him, but he is absolutely the backbone of OMIP for many, many years. That aside, you don't get that opportunity to talk about the citizens in your communities that give, volunteer for 20 years, give their hearts and souls to some of these programs. You've heard a lot of statistics and facts, and I don't want to go into that. I gave you a brief overview of the OMIP program about 2 weeks ago, so I kind of want to get to the heart of this. And, Chair Greenlink, if you just go like this when I bog down, and I'll kind of skip through. But I want to make sure you understand that the board of OMIP makes decisions around benefits, premiums, and assessments. They have some statutory guidelines around benefits. Is the portability plans has to equal kind of the portability plans of Department of Consumer and Business Services. The medical plans have to equal generally what's offered in the group market. Premiums can be no more than 125% of the standard charged for similar coverage in the commercial market. And on assessments, they're the ones that make the decisions around what to assess insurers for operating losses. It's important to note, for every dollar in premium we receive, we expend about $1.60 to $1.70 in claims costs. And those losses get passed on an assessment. In turn, the insurers pass along to all policyholders within the state. So all of our losses basically get passed to about 1.8 million folks out there who have either group or individual coverage. But it's the board that makes those decisions in the spirit of that law and within the constraints of that law. If you look at the last assessment, for example, our losses totaled about $27 million projected for the next 5 months. That included building up of some reserves because we expended a lot of money in the previous 6 months. That equaled $3.21 per insured per month. So if you are a carrier and you have a one insured that you're covering, then you're going to pay OMIP approximately $15, 5 months of assessment times that $3.21, or $15. If you have two insured, $30. If you have a million insured, then you're going to pay about $15 million. So depending on how many people you have insured in the state, depending what that assessment is, you pay it to OMIP based on the losses. If you are enrolled with PEB right now, and you have yourself and two other family members, four of you, $12 or $13 a month of your premium you pay through PEB, or the state pays, goes to support the OMIP assessment. I think that's important because when you look at, first of all, affordability of health care, David's right. No one can afford this stuff. It keeps going up 10, 15, 20% a year. So OMIP folks are no different than a small group or an individual. But what the board strives to do is find the balance within the guidelines of the statute of what they can charge in premiums and what the impact is on the assessment as it gets passed through to small and large employers and individuals. The best way to do this is to look at, there's a chart in the back, and it's called G1, second to the last one. Gives you kind of a 10-year history of where our rates and our surcharge have been. Let everybody get to that. And you should say age 55 to 59 premium. There's a G1 and a G2. If you look at that, you go back to 1998, and the board imposed a surcharge of 125%, or 25% over an average. Now, it's a little difficult to compare these year to year because benefits do change. But generally, it gives you, I think, a good feel of what's happened. On the other side of that, you see what the premium was and then the premium increase for that particular year. If you go up to the top, it shows you what we've done in the last 4 years. 2004, we were at a 2% surcharge. That was the year we saw a 19% premium. The reason the board stated a 2% surcharge was because the cost in the private sector was going up 20-25%.
Excuse me, Rock.
Yep.
In the context we're talking about now of 125% versus 100%, that would be 102%. Is that what you're saying?
That would be correct.
Thank you.
That would be correct. As you can see, that the board tries to use the ability to go between 100 and 125 surcharge as a way of kind of mitigating some of the price increases and decreases that you see in the market. Overall, this last year, we saw prices decrease about 13% for OMIP. That resulted in 11% surcharge. It's hard to sometimes figure out why that would be, but some of the major market carriers in the individual market reduced their rates this year, so we saw a decrease even though we stayed at 111%. When the board first started out, we had an ability to be at 150%. That changed in 1996 and dropped it to 125. And as you can see, in the last 10 years for this particular age bracket, we've only been at 125 twice, and we've been as low as 102. A couple points. There are about 30 pools throughout the country, high-risk pools, very similar to Oregon's. We are, I think, without exception, historically the lowest in terms of surcharges. Most high-risk pools are from 125 to 150. We have some as high as 200%. Oregon has always been the leader, I think, in terms of trying to bring affordability to their high-risk pool. I want to stress the balance that has to be kind of voted on. On the board, there are five insurers. They could control the vote. There's nine members on the board. You have two advocates, a provider, and the director of Department of Consumer Services. But the insurers have stepped forward and have been willing, I think, to balance affordability and the impact on their assessment. It's in their interests, yes, to some degree, to set the premiums at 125%. And I am proud of the fact they have stepped back and said, while that may be in our interests, it's also in the interests of those enrolled to keep that premium as low as we can keep it. So it's been a continual balancing act that they've had to really address for since the inception of the pool in 1990 with our first policies. So that's kind of a summary. I think I have more detail in here about the history of the losses if you want to get into that, but it's I just want to point out, I think this is a struggle that the board always has. They have the power to set it at 100 now, and they have the power to set it at 125, and I think they've used that very judiciously in the last 10 years to create the best balance they could.
Any questions? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Rocky. So when evaluating the policy consequences of the bill that's before us, I just want to make sure I understand what would happen if the bill was passed as written. And A, the first thing that would happen is that people covered under this plan would likely pay less, or at least would pay closer to the market rate for private individual insurance. B, the assessment that you levy on insurers would go up. And can you talk about how much that assessment would rise?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Cannon. It's about $3.6 million, so about 10 to 12% of our current assessment.
Okay, so the assessment would increase 10 to 12%.
Yeah. That's not per year.
That would be per 6 months. That would be correct. So it would be 6 to 7 million for an entire year. We do our assessments every 6 months, so I was thinking in those terms.
Please,
go ahead.
So that $3 a month figure that I think is per insured per month would rise also in the range of 10 to 12%. So there'd be another
Chair,
Representative 30
cents. That would be correct.
Okay.
That would be correct.
Are there any other policy consequences of this that we need to understand that would be helpful to those people who are on the pool by regulating their rates? It would cost all of everyone else who's not on the pool but does carry this kind of coverage, does carry insurance coverage, an extra some number of cents per month.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cannon, I think it's important. Remember, our rates are average rates. So when people say they're paying 10% more than the commercial market, that's true for half the commercial market. But half the other half of the commercial market, because our rates are an average, are really above that 100%, whether they're 105, 115. So our rates with some carriers are actually a little less than some carriers. Now, hopefully what keeps people from just coming to our pool is that they have to actually be denied coverage. So it's not that I'm healthy, I'm going to OMIP. You have to be denied coverage or have a specific condition to get in. But the balance that you have is, to the degree that you increase OMIP rates, you reduce the assessment. If you decrease the rates, you increase the assessment. Ultimately, somebody is going to drop coverage at the other end when their rates continue to go up, because it's just not OMIP rates pushing rates higher. The cost of utilization, drugs, or whatever it may be. But I will tell you that the OMIP assessment is as large a piece now, or a bigger piece, that carriers are now listing that in their quotes. They want you to know, this is what it costs you to get insured, and by the way, here's how much you're paying in the OMIP assessment. 15 years ago, when it was 20 cents, 30 cents, 40 cents, it got lost. But now they're putting it up because employers, small and large, want to know, why are my costs going up?
Certainly anybody can get qualified. All they have to say, they've been diagnosed with hypertension, and their application will get denied. Representative Moore?
They have to be denied, sir, by the insurance company. They have to bring them a denial to them to get the insurance.
Yeah, all I'm saying is, in the individual application, if they're 55 years old, they just have to say they've been diagnosed with hypertension and they'll be denied.
But they have to apply to the regular company.
No, they don't. Yeah, he's right.
Rocky, I'm a little bit confused in the fact that I know when I pay insurance for or very small business, that there's an OMIP assessment, and I agree. But as a provider, when we're looking at payments, I pay as a provider into that risk pool so that I actually get less reimbursement as a provider. So I'm being, you know, I could bring copies of these.
Could you explain what you said, Rocky?
But
As
a provider, and because I'm not an expert in this field, I guess I'm asking you to explain this. Providers and primary care pay a certain percentage of what would be our reimbursement. So we only get reimbursed 95-98% of our contracted rate, and the doctor kicks back in X percent into this risk pool. So all these doctors are paying into the risk pool. Is that relatively accurate?
Mr. Chair, Representative Maurer, I don't think it is.
Okay.
You may be talking about Medicaid or Medicare. We're not OMAP, or DMAP, I guess they call it today. OMIP uses basically the provider network of Blue Cross Blue Shield. We pay commercial rates. We're considered a commercial product. So there is no discount that any provider has to take other than their contract with Blue Cross Blue Shield, which is their normal contract they do with the other million people they have under it. Now, you may have an arrangement as a provider with a carrier for what they call a risk withhold, but that has nothing to do with OMIP.
It is not the OMIP risk withhold.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh,
I
not the
that, that may be.
I know what that
it's
is.
It's just I'm getting this.
Yeah.
You know.
There are risk withhold holds
right.
In certain contracting relationships that insurers and providers have. But OMIP, other than as we are as a normal Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield business, contracts are part of that.
Mr. Petrico, are you still with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay, good.
I apologize, Mr. Chair.
No, that's what we're here for, to ask questions. That's great. Any other questions of Mr. King? I just have one last question. I think what's worrying you, and I'd really like to get it maybe on the record, and Mr. Hawk and I have had this conversation, is that somewhere along the line, this is a delegate balance. Somebody else? Oh, good. This is a delicate balance. it's a sort of dance between the insurance companies who are willing to say, okay, we can have 15,000 high-risk people out there in this pool, we'll pick up the assessment. And what seems to be worrying you is that assessment gets out of hand, it may throw the insurance industry to say, no, we just don't want to do this anymore. We'll talk to Mr. Becker in a moment.
Mr. Chair, you know, again, there are people like David have great advocates, great respect for. I have great respect for the Providences, for the Blue Crosses and the ODSs and the health nets that have been on our board who vote a tax to themselves through the assessment. And watching them balance the issue of the impact of the assessment and the affordability to our folks, I'm really proud of all the folks that participated in these decisions. And I am worried that if you tilt it too far one way, that you lose that support.
Yes, please.
Mr. Chair, this may or may not be a real question, maybe a comment. It appears to me from what we're hearing that we have a $27 million loss from the last report, that the cost in benefits is between $1.60 and $1.70 for every dollar of premium that's currently paid, and that in the last 10 years, there's only been 2 years where the limit of 125% has even been reached, and that in the last 5 years, it's been about 8% over, so it's like $1.08 for every dollar, although in the last 3 years, it's been at 11%. And so the discussion about being at 125 or $1.25, 125% is under the law, but we've really been at $1.11 for the last 3 years and even less than that before that. And from the testimony, it appears that the board really is working to keep it as low as possible to maintain that balance, and that the idea of just going down legally from $1.25 to $1 when we have a board that's at $1.11 right now, or 111%, it would be nice to do, but there's going to have to be a cost somewhere, and that it looks to me like the board has really worked to keep it as low as possible to maintain that balance.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our last witness is Mike Becker, Regents. Please.
Representative or Chairman Greenlich and members of the committee, my name is Mike Becker with Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. By way of full disclosure, Regents is the contracted administrator for the OMIP program. And I am a former OMIP board member. Our plan president, Dr. Bart McMullen, is currently on the OMIP board. I'd like to testify today in opposition to House Bill 2440. And what I'd like to cover in my testimony that is being handed out to the committee today is a little background about the legislative history on OMIP when this program was implemented and how that speaks to the issue before us today. Talk a little bit more about the balance that Rocky King has alluded to. I think that's a point that does bear emphasis. And talk about the comparison of Oregon's high-risk pool to what we see around the country when we compare this. So back to that legislative history. OMIP was established in 1987 with the express legislative intent to maintain a balance. And here's what it says in the statute at 735-600. To provide access to medical insurance coverage to all residents of this state who are denied adequate medical insurance while at the same time avoiding undue financial impact on the state and on private insurers. OMIP medical insurance was never intended to compete with the commercial individual insurance market, nor was OMIP ever intended to be an insurance pool for low-income enrollees. Rather, OMIP is open to individuals who have applied for and been denied eligibility in the individual market because of medical underwriting. And we have a separate program here in Oregon, the FEOP program, that does provide premium subsidies for eligible low-income individuals. That program is available both for OMIP enrollees as well as commercial market enrollees. As Rocky noted, the OMIP board maintains a very good balance between these competing interests that they must wrestle with every time they meet and discuss benefits, assessments, premiums, etc. And those interests are the impact of the premiums on the OMIP enrollees, the increased carrier assessment, which is in turn passed on to the commercial market, the enrollment and eligibility, the benefit design, member cost sharing, and administrative costs. Constantly, those things are all at issue when the OMIP board meets and addresses these issues. The board has a history of looking at these things and setting the assessment, the premium setting the premium in such a way that it balances these various objectives. It should also be noted that in that chart that is attached to my testimony and also attached to Rocky's testimony, again, that rarely has this premium assessment, this cap, premium cap, been up at the 125% level. It's also important to note that the benefit design that Oregon OMIP medical enrollees have is not apples to apples to the commercial individual market. So if we were to move the assessment cap down to 100% and we limited that board discretion, what OMIP enrollees get for that 100% is a much richer benefit than what the commercial market has for individual enrollees. The OMIP benefit is tied more to the commercial group premium, the small group benefits, than it is to the individual market benefits. So it's a much richer benefit than you could buy in the individual market. If we were to limit the carrier, the board's discretion, it may destabilize the carrier and public support for the OMIP program. Lowering the maximum medical premium to 100% of the market average allows OMIP medical enrollees to avoid paying any share of the increased medical risk that they bring to the OMIP pool. This additional risk is again passed on to carriers through the assessment and then to the insurance buying public. If you look at the attachment to my testimony, you'll see a chart showing the history of the OMIP medical loss ratios as well as the carrier assessments over the years. OMIP, as Rocky noted, may be one of the most successful high-risk pools in the U.S. If you look at Oregon with its population compared to the five other states with the highest enrollment in their medical risk pools, you'll see that there is no state anywhere near the size of Oregon that has a high-risk pool enrollment the way we do. So we have a very successful program. We have carriers who are supportive of the program in the administration of the benefits, the premiums, and the assessment. You'll see a chart attached to my testimony with that information about the comparison to other states. Finally, no other state high-risk pool limits its medical premium surcharge to 100%. And the last attachment to my testimony shows the comparison of Oregon to the other states that have high-risk pools. You'll note that there are three states with a maximum premium limitation of 125%. One state ostensibly allows lower than 125%. That's Maryland, where they have a range where the board must set premiums no less than 110% nor more than 200% of market. And then you compare that to the other states, and you will see that most of the states that have high-risk pools have a premium assessment for this high-risk population far in excess of 150% of the marketplace. So with that, I'll take any questions, and I would thank you for your offer, and I would urge you to not pass this bill. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I saw Mr. Houck and Mr. King disagreeing with a portion on the apples-to-apples piece of that.
Can I speak to it?
Would you mind if they did that?
You can speak to it for 1 minute.
Thank you.
Please be brief.
Thank you very much. Again, my name is Dave Houck, and it seems to me that the six plans that we have in OMIP, we took from Blue Cross Blue Shield. Everything that we have in the plan is exactly like Blue Cross's. So when you're don't compare apples to apples. I'm sorry, I only have the rates here, but if you took what Blue Cross has in their plans, we offer in our plans, and that's all we offer. So
but the suggestion when it's the Blue Cross group plan rather than the Blue Cross individual plan. Is that a correct statement? Rocky, you want to join this?
Just take a minute, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Ms. Chair, again, for the record, my name is Rocky King. I'm the administrator for OMIT. By statute, we base our benefit plans on the most common benefit plans that are offered in the group market. Okay, so we survey, we kind of have an idea of what goes on in the group market because a lot of the mandates are there. And the reason the group rather than the individual is when the national model was established, there was a recognition that these people had a lot of chronic health conditions, and we wanted to make sure that they got the services and the benefits. So correct there. However, they are turned down for the individual market, so the premiums are based on the individual market, which doesn't have the same benefits as the group market. So what do? We take the benefit plan for the individual market and look at its price. We take our plan, and we adjust the prices as if the individual market had the same benefits. Example, this individual market plan costs $100. Our group plan, but it doesn't have mental health. Well, we have mental health, so what do? We take that $100 and we add the 5% or 2% or 9%, whatever the actuaries have. So we do true up the costs between the individual and group. The actuaries from Blue Cross and the Department of Consumer and Business Services Insurance Division, some of the other firms provide some actuary or insurance companies actuarial services to us. So it becomes apples and apples once you make those benefit differential adjustments. So they're both kind of right.
Good, thank you for clarifying that. 30 seconds?
Well, your last 30 seconds was 3.5 minutes.
Rocky's,
how about holding 30 seconds to a minute?
What Rocky is saying is exactly right. The only problem is the apples and the oranges. We do have a big assessments. But if you consider, if we were a state that had... rights to where anybody can buy any insurance. You have open enrollment where you can buy from any plan. I think there are two or three on the East Coast that has them. This problem of the assessment would not be there. It would be across all of the insurance companies. The reason I raised the, and my figures show the 36 cents and the $4 a year, that's not the total assessment. He's right, the assessment is large. But what I'm saying, you knock off the and go to 100% of a normal policy, it will cost $4 a year.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Are there any other questions to Mr. Becker? Thank you very much for coming in. Yeah, he still is. Mr. Patrico, you're still there, right?
Yes, I am.
We're about to close the hearing in a moment. I need first to acknowledge some testimony, some written testimony provided by Pacific Source Health Plans, which I assume are opposed to this bill. Is that right?
Correct.
Yes. Okay, with that, I'll close the hearing on House Bill 2440, and thank you all for testifying. And Mr. Patrico, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Did that do it? Yeah. And we'll adjourn the committee on the subcommittee on health access, and remind you all that at 5 o'clock we will join, if you want, the Senate committee on something or other. What's the Senate committee? On healthcare reform.